You got it.
Okay. Abani Ganya, everyone. This is Professor Amin-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, Africana Studies Department, where I taught there for 34 years. And I'm also a former city councilman for the city of Compton. I also was elected in 1995 to the Compton College Board of Trustees. And in 1991, I was elected to the Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We are honored to have you chime in today because we have a very special program. This is the Conscious Corner. The term came from our brother historian Joe Hembert, who may join us. He's a co-host, as well as we thank Brother Rashiki Maskani, also known as a teacher and educator, Rigo Moore, formerly. But at the same time, for providing us this platform through the Community Education Network to provide nothing but facts about Black, nothing but Black truth. And we thank him for his hard work, his generosity, and his insight, foresight, and hindsight to establish this podcast so that we can educate our people. One of the most important things that we find to be the most effective weapon is our education against the indoctrination by the Eurocentric society. So we have a very special guest today, a longtime activist and a person that have used technology, computer technology, as a tool and a weapon to educate our people, our young people in the education system. But at the same time, he does his personal research and he's developed a program tonight called The Negro Mentality, The History of the Negro Mentality, where he's doing research by getting vintage videos and vintage pictures and vintage statements and concepts and quotes and statements from individuals during the 1960s and that were summoned to give commentary on our status with regards to the Watts Rebellion, with regards to the civil rights, voting rights, and with regards to the assassination of Malcolm X, as well as other issues that we faced during that period. This will be a series. He has a 28-minute video that we will show after his commentary. And we really thank Brother Hood. He likes just being called Brother Hood. Hood means to protect. That's why you wear a hood, you understand? To protect. So that's an Afrocentric perspective. Neighborhood, you understand? So we deeply appreciate him who do his research and he thinks and he feels and he hopes that we get what he intend for us to get out of this educational process. So without further delay, I'm gonna turn the program over to Brother Hood. You there, Brother Hood?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. All right. Thank you. Yes, thank you. It's an honor today to be here to present this to you today. The purpose of this presentation today is to raise the consciousness. That's what I'm here to do, raise the consciousness level, and doing it with a panel and reflection on the work of Dr. Clark. And as well as Professor Ra. Everyone has someone that they look up to and admire, and his work has had a profound impact and effect on understanding the social constraints or constructs during this time period. I stand here today honored to be able to share this content with you, and I was shocked and excited when I was able to find it and share it. So today, you will see in the video, how important this work is and continues to be. Dr. Clark has so many works, and my goal today is to reintroduce Dr. Clark to a younger generation for those who are new to his work. And not by just talking about him, but by reflecting on the work in this hidden gem. This documentary was originally broadcast back in 1965. And so basically, what I'm looking at here is over the past century, the standard term for has shifted for us. It was colored Negro, Black, and now African American. This change can be seen as an attempt to redefine ourselves and get respect and standing in society. Would you agree?
Yes.
So here we are, history of the Negro mentality and identity. And so what we're going to have is a video reflection and a panel to discuss the work of Dr. Clark. And before I do that, I want to just talk about consciousness. What is consciousness? What is the definition? Aware of and responding to one's surroundings. Similar to the word aware, awake, wide awake, compos mentis, alert, responsive, reacting, and feeling. And so, again, my goal today with this documentary is to raise your level of consciousness about what was going on during this time. And I have a treasure trove of content, and I'm looking forward to sharing it and yielding back to the panel. You know, any highlights and things that you have come to mind. What I want you guys to think about today, before you watch the video, is these reflection questions. Who created the word Negro? What are the goals for broadcasting a documentary like this in 1965? What do you think the positive or negative impacts in our community were for this documentary? What were the misconceptions or falsehoods presented based on what we know now about our history? What information can you add or clarify topics based discussed in the documentary? So these are the things that you want to think about as we watch the documentary, and we'll come back to those questions at the end. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about also was actually what happened in 1965, because Professor Rob, he had a unique perspective on it. I think he was 11th grade during this time. And as we can see, Malcolm X was shot on the February 21st, similar to Montgomery March. On March 7th, Voting Rights Act became a law, August 6th, and the LA West Rebellion broke out. And so here are some quotes that I wanted to provide from Dr. Henry Clark. The woman is the giver of life. You cannot have society where one half of the society is barred from full participation in society. You cannot imprison her brain and build a new society because you need the input of all minds. You still have to let her have the ability to let her mind go and be creative and to make her creative contribution to the totality of society without demeaning a single man. That's from My Life in Search of Africa, Dr. John Henry Clark. The next one is powerful people cannot afford to educate the people they oppress, because once you are truly educated, you will not ask for power, you will take it.
Nothing more to say at this point. Give you an update as soon as we can.
Okay, my last quote here is from Professor Waugh.
We're watching.
If we kept thinking nothing was going to change, then we would still be in change. That's a great quote. And so I just wanted to share that with you guys. And also, we can start the video. Let's check it out.
The people now called Negroes are the most and the least understood of the world's people.
This term Negro demoralizes us and is detrimental. I feel that it doesn't give us any association past the slave ship.
I think that the first task of people of African descent, whether in the United States or in Africa or elsewhere, is to get rid of this slave named Negro.
This curious word Negro was seldom or never used in Africa itself. And this word has no meaning or no worthwhile meaning at all in Africa. I would doubt myself if it has any useful meaning anywhere else.
What is a Negro? A simple question, but the answer is not so simple. My name is Ossie Davis. I'm an actor and a writer. and the narrator of our series of programs on the history of the Negro people. I also a Negro. What is a Negro? In Africa, the word Negro has no meaning. In Brazil, a Negro is a man who's very poor and very black. And in the United States, a man who has any quantity of Negro blood, or whatever that is considered a Negro. Are Negroes a race, people, or a condition? Our programs will be asking this question in many ways and in many different settings. Our odyssey will take us throughout the world to Africa, where we will explore the relationship of American Negroes to the land of their origin. To Brazil, where we will ask, is Brazil a racial paradise? And throughout the United States. Our aim in this series is both a modest and an ambitious one. We will be asking many questions and perhaps answer only a few. For there is a vast ignorance of Negro history among whites and Negroes. And the job of filling this vacuum is massive. Do Negroes have a heritage and a tradition like the Greeks, the French, the Anglo-Saxons? Or are we something less, as others have portrayed us? Everywhere we have looked, we have seen Negroes as savage and barbaric, humble and self-sacrificing, scared and childish and inferior. And I remember as a kid coming from some of the pictures, and we spent the whole time from the motion picture house to home satirizing the Negro performances we saw in the film. Well, it was also an admission that somehow or other, this was to some degree what we were. Now, these important and very, very impressionistic things that we got from these films did to some degree govern our behavior. When a Negro child goes into a movie, for instance, and sees himself or sees another Negro in an unfavorable light, he feels to some degree threatened. He feels uncomfortable, and a great deal of his laughing at that situation will be the kind of laughter that protects him. It's a nervous attack against him, himself, the way he looks at himself, the esteem with which he holds himself, and how he will rate with his fellows in the streets. You know, it's seeing something happen to you that you can't control, which leaves a scar, which leaves you feeling inadequate. You know, you don't feel loved. You're ashamed to look at yourself, ashamed to go home, ashamed to talk to the boys next door, ashamed even to ask these questions of your parents, although sometimes you do. It's a horrible situation, and sometimes we never get over that.
As a Negro, I honestly tried to believe that I was somebody, and I've always fought during my life to keep that feeling that I did have some value, and I say value knowing what that word means. And there's been many a night in my life when I've gone to sleep and known very deep inside me that I really wasn't worth much.
I still do not really know what being a Negro is or what it means. It means that my skin is a little bit darker. It means that my cultural exposures have been somewhat different to other ethnic groups. It may even mean that as a human being, I might be more sensitive to need and despair.
Well, yes, you know, that wish I was white kind of thing. When you begin to sort of get the feeling of difference, like maybe you're dirty, something's wrong. But there was that feeling, you know. Well, really, you can't even remember where it started. I'm not over it yet. It's part of my American heritage.
We were told we were a people without a past and without a future. And Negro boys and girls learned before very long that they were something special.
Do
you know, at an early age, as soon as you start school, you begin to catch on to the whole racial thing. But once you get into school, you begin to know it and know there's a difference and that the difference is against you.
There's no real reference to me as a Negro or to my father or any of the other Negroes who have contributed so much to the growth of the United States. And I really can't understand it.
I'll never forget the picture in the geography book of a couple of very ragged Africans, you know. Weeks before we got to the lesson, we were stealing ourselves for it. Some Negro child would find the picture first in the book before we got to the lesson and alert everyone. Look on page 22, you see what's there. And then we dreaded reaching that lesson because it was always something about the savages not knowing anything. And we had to sit there and hear this. And instinctively, the white children would turn and look at the Negro children, you know, while this lesson was going on.
And so, Africa became our shame and our torment. We were told that our past was barbarism and the white man our redeemer. Slavery was a sin, but salvation. Few of us had anything to look forward to. We were afraid to look back. In 1958, Lorraine Hansberry wrote a play, A Raisin in the Sun, that showed the conflicts created for American Negroes by their African past.
Well, what have we got in the mind? You are now looking at what a well-dressed Nigerian woman would wear. Isn't that beautiful?
Hey, look, honey, we're going to the theater. We're not going to be in it, you know.
George, I don't like that. Do you expect this boy to go out with you looking like that? Well, now that's up to George, if he's ashamed of his heritage.
Oh, dear. Here we go again. A lecture on our African past and our great Western heritage. In 1 second, you know, we're going to hear all about the great Ashanti empires, the Songhay civilizations, the sculpture of Benin, some poems in the Bantu, and then the whole monologue is going to end up with the word heritage. Said, baby, your heritage ain't nothing but a bunch of raggedy spirit crap.
So I wanted to pause it there because this is one of the parts that I wanted to kind of talk about a little bit when you talk about the word Negro. So What would you say? I mean, what are you saying based on this situation? Is this what it means to be a Negro? Are you saying not being proud of where you come from? Is that what this video is trying to represent? And it's really a good look into, you know, relationships at that time. But it's really interesting when you think about it. And so those are some of the things that I wanted to talk about, because when you look at this video, I'm basically looking at it from a producer's aspect and what are the concepts or what are they trying to get across in the video. So this is one point that I wanted to touch on later. We can talk about on the panel.
What? You would rather stand there in your splendid ignorance and know absolutely nothing about the people who were the first to smell iron on the face of this earth while the Ashanti were performing surgical operations. When the English were still tattooing themselves with blue dragons.
At the Heritage Program of How You Act, a federally sponsored effort to develop better opportunities for Harlem's Negro youth, a new version of African history is being taught. Robert Moore is a visiting lecturer.
Mr. Moore, we think that the so-called Negro would dignify his identity by associating himself with his ancestral background.
After some 300 or 400 years of transplantation from Africa into America, it is obvious that we are not Africans anymore. We are Afro-Americans. Americans of African ancestry. And that connects us, basically, with our original heritage and culture.
The accomplishments of Africa before and after...
Director of the program is John Henrik Clark.
This accomplishment is generally glossed over or neglected in human history. A lot of this, the misconception of Africa and the distortion of African history is involved in a word that is relatively new, the word Negro, a kind of nickname that grew out of European laziness, the inability or the lack of a desire to give Africans their proper identity. In the period when the Europeans had to justify the exploitation of Africa and the demeaning of a whole people, they systematically started the effort to read the African out of human history.
A great deal of ignorance of African history sits upon the old conservative racial discrimination and prejudice which we have had in Europe.
Basil Davidson is a British writer and historian on Africa.
States. It still sits upon the belief, perfectly unscientific, quite unbased in any scholarly discipline, that the Africans, that is to say, if you like, the Negroes, are people of some sort of inferiority to others and therefore have not been able to develop in the same way. Now, you know, the great myth of the colonial era, the great myth took the shape of saying that the Africans, the Negroes, are children, and because they are children, it said, failing to develop, we the Europeans, you the Americans, must go in there and show them the way they should go, civilize them, introduce them to the blessings of orderly life. One of the misunderstandings, you see, about Africa is the apparently primitive material nature of their civilization. You look at these people living in these villages and you wonder, what is their past? Do they have a past? What lies behind it all? They have nothing but a few straw buildings, nothing but a few cattle. It seems quite inconsiderable. The Dinka, for example, have no stone in their country. They have almost no metal. Half their country is underwater half the year. They cannot build and could never possibly build an imposing material civilization. But their achievement was, of course, to learn how to master their environment. And this they have done with quite outstanding success, so that the outside picture, the superficial picture, gives no indication at all of the depth of their culture. These are the people who have mastered the problems of taming this difficult, vast continent with all its extraordinarily great obstacles to living, its swamps, its deserts, its mountains, and its forests. The story of Africa over the last 2,000 years has been one of quite epic dimensions.
Africa. Endless deserts, scorching and windswept by day. Bitterly cold at night. And the Sahara. The world's largest desert, a harsh, bleak expanse of land, challenging anyone to cross it. Snow-capped mountains near the equator, gigantic waterfalls. In the jungle mists and rain almost daily. These were some of the barriers to penetration. To the outside world, it was the dark continent, a land of mystery, where stories were spread of giants and dwarfs, a people whose heads grew under their arms, monstrous animals. It is here, in this forbidding other world that what may be the remains of the first man were discovered. In 1959, in Tanganyika, a scientific expedition had been digging for weeks in the sun-baked earth, looking for traces of the earliest man. Then, in July, Dr. Lewis Leakey and his team found what he called Zinjanthropus, nicknamed the Nutcracker Man because of the strength of his jaws. He was about 600,000 years old, and maybe the creature that makes Africa the real cradle of mankind. The records of ancient Africa begin with Egypt about 3000 BC. Its spectacular achievements of the monumental pyramid and brooding sphinx have always been credited to Asia and the Mediterranean. But there is growing evidence that Egypt owes more than originally thought to the land to the south, Kush, the land of the Negroes. About 700 BC, Kushite kings conquer Egypt and become the 25th dynasty. Little is known today about the land of Kush, but in the ancient world, it was highly respected. In 1791, the French philosopher Count Duvalney wrote of the Kushites, a people now forgotten, discovered while others were yet barbarians, the elements of arts and the sciences. Then, in about 325 AD, Kush is attacked and destroyed and disappears from our view. For the rest of Africa, there is little we can say for certain. Except for the Kushites, Africans had no writing. They kept in their memories the history of their people. Stories narrated down from generation to generation. This oral tradition must tell us much of the history that will fill the gaps in our knowledge. In the Western Sudan, Negro kingdoms arise in the medieval periods of walled and fortified cities, markets, and fairs. Ghana is the earliest of these civilizations, going back to 300 AD. In the 8th century, an Arab writer tells us that the Arabs sent an expedition to this pagan land of gold. African markets, the main source of gold before the discovery of America. Then, about 1067, Arabs from the north, fired by their new faith, storm into the Western Sudan. Conquer Ghana and settle there. From this time on, Trans-Saharan caravan trade flourishes, and with the trade comes Islam. Islam spreads through West Africa. When Europe was going through a so-called Dark Ages, Muslim culture is the main advancement of human knowledge. Most important of all, a written language comes to the Western Sudan. Almost all that we know about these kingdoms was preserved for us by Arab and Negro scholars of that time. Around the 12th century, Ghana gives way to the Empire of Mali. In 1324, King Mansa Musa makes a pilgrimage to Mecca with a caravan of 60,000 people. An Arab traveler arriving in Mali in 1353 wrote, "The Negroes have a greater abhorrence of injustice than any other people. Neither traveler nor inhabitant of this land has anything to fear from robbers or men of violence." Could the same be said of the 14th century England or France? The Kingdom of Songhai, most famous for its university, the fabled Timbuktu. Students and scholars from all over the world came here to study. A Moorish traveler wrote, "More profit is made from the book trade than from all other branches of commerce."
If we ask ourselves a little more nearly, what have been the cultural contributions of African peoples to the rest of the world, then of course we are faced immediately with the remarkably original and outstanding quality of their plastic arts. The most important art in Africa has, of course, been dancing. And dancing has passed into the folklore of the whole of the rest of the world from its African origins. If you go to places like Brazil or the West Indies or the southern United States, you will find African dances still being danced there, though, of course, in different circumstances and therefore in somewhat different ways. But the whole concept of rhythm as being an expression of the personality, not simply a wiggling of the body. And a wiggling of the body is all that most Europeans can achieve. But an expression of the personality, this comes from the African concept of dancing. More obvious is the tradition of plastic art. A large number of African peoples have developed forms of sculpture in wood, or in stone, or in ivory, or in brass, or bronze, or iron, or gold, which are of great effectiveness and great originality. And this too, of course, is passed into the general Western tradition of pictorial art, and to some extent of plastic art as well.
The remarkable art of Benin and Ife. The bronzes of Benin were said to be worthy of Cellini. Europe was amazed at the discovery that Africans could perform such an impressive creation of bronze casting. African sculpture burst upon the European art world. It became a major influence in the modern movement. Picasso, Braque, Modigliani, Leger, Derain found in African sculpture a freedom and a vitality they had been searching for. Here was no slavish imitation of nature, something the camera could do better, but a new and fresh way of looking at the world behind the appearance.
We have only skimmed the surface of the history of African civilizations, and there are wide gaps in our knowledge. Among the riddles of ancient Africa are: where did the Negro come from? What happened to the Kushites after their defeat? Where did the sculptors of Benin learn their remarkable skills? We haven't even begun to penetrate some of these mysteries. Yet, growing knowledge and interest in Africa is rediscovering a world we never knew. And many Negroes are examining for the first time the values that were lost.
My name is Yulumi B, and I'm addressing my question to Mr. Clark. I want to know what happened to the so-called Negro culture in America.
The most tragic destruction of African culture was the destruction of the African culture brought to these shores, brought to America's shores. Now, the first thing they did was to forbid the drum, forbid all African ceremonies, forbid African ornaments, literally to destroy a people in such a manner that they had to be remade in an American image. This was not exactly true in the West Indies. It was slavery, make no mistake about it. But because it was on an island, many of the Africans could communicate with each other and maintain some of the African culture, while in the United States, it was impossible because as they arrived, mother, brother, sister split up and they went in opposite directions. Then they were resold. They might have been resold within a matter of days after they were sold the last time. So it was difficult for relatives to keep track of each other. And it was difficult for a continuity to be maintained in African culture. This was the beginning of the fragmenting of our family in this country. It was also the beginning of the demeaning and the negation of the masculinity of the black male in America. This demeaning of our culture and this reading us out of the commentary of human history has left deep psychological scars. What we are trying to do now is a massive job of rebuilding the inside, the spirits, the hopes, the history, the culture of a people. We're trying to restore those values that have been taken away, and we're trying to get across to black youth that they have a part to play in the making of a new world. They have the imagination, they have the energy. You must first restore that part of yourself that has been negated by oppression. It is as essential to you as bread and water. It is part of the food that must feed your spirit and the world of tomorrow. And it is part of what you will have to transfer to your children.
All right. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
All right, great. So thank you guys who showed up late. I wanted to give you guys the QR code. If you showed up late and you wanted to catch the full documentary, you can go ahead and scan this QR code. And before we start our dialogue, this is what I wanted to reflect on. These are some reflection questions. What were the goals for broadcasting a documentary like this back in 1965? What do you think the positive or negative impacts in our community were for this documentary? What were the misconceptions or falsehoods presented based on what we know now about our history? And I'm yielding to the panel and those of you who have done your own research, anything you want to share, any knowledge you have or on your own insight. Also, any information that you can clarify on the topics that were discussed in the documentary. And what I wanted to do right here is give you guys a couple of textbooks. So years ago when I was doing my undergrad at Cal State Fullerton, I joined a club called AIPAC. It was a Alliance for the Preservation of African Consciousness. And what we did was basically read textbooks. And one of the textbooks that really helped me was The Black Man of the Nile and His Family. It's kind of like a reference book. It was done by Dr. Ben. And also I kind of got a list of 1,100 books. I have it on my website. So I wanted to share that with you. You can check it out right here on the link, and I'll go ahead and just kind of give you an idea of what's on this list. It's about 1,100 books of conscious study. If you wanted to download it, I'll put the link in the chat, and then you can go ahead and download the link. I'll just pull it up real quick. But this was something that was done by Michael Gibson back in 1990, and then we compiled it by Chuck Moore and it updated back in 1997. But it's broken down based by author, and also it gives you different authors and the books they have, and it's kind of categorized by black and white authors. So if you're on a journey and you're looking up information, you're trying to find textbooks to read, this is a really good list. And I think I've shared this with Professor Mr. Hembrick as well. So I think he's went through this as quite a, it's an extensive list. So you can check that out also. And one of the things I wanted to do next is just kind of let you guys know. My topic and my pathway is technology, and I am doing another podcast on the 25th, and I'm going to deconstruct game design. I am an educator. I teach game design and advanced placement computer science principles. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is kind of deconstruct some of the strategies that are used in these video games. There's about four of them that basically make games highly addictive. And so give parents and people awareness on what to look for and what to understand about behavior when you're playing some of these games, and just kind of understand what goes into some of these games and why they're so addictive. And this is my channel, Mr. Hood Business Technology Academy. You can check me out. And this concludes my presentation. So I wanted to turn it over now to the panel, and we can discuss the topics. Like I said before, what were the goals you think, and you know, some of the impacts on this topic. Thank you.
Well, you got me again, Brother Hood, for the excellent presentation and the thought-provoking questions that you've listed. So we'll start with Brother Gunn. Do you have any, you have your hand up, do you have any questions or concepts you'd like to share, Brother Gunn? Okay, Gunn, you're on mute. You're on mute. What about Lamar Guillory? Are you there, Lamar? Okay, yeah. There, Brother Gunn yes. Is on.
Go ahead. Okay.
Go ahead, Brother Gunn. We can't hardly hear you. We can't hardly hear you. You got to talk closer to the mic.
Hello?
Yeah, sorry about that. That was, okay. I guess it was an accident on me putting my hands up. I'm really just trying to take in what's going on. I don't,
okay.
You don't have no questions and no comments?
Not at this time. No.
All right, then. Brother Lamar Guillory?
Yes. First of all, thank you for putting this on, Brother Hood.
Thanks, Lamar.
Yeah, my first thought about what was the goal of this documentary, I mean, definitely to educate. I think on a national level, you know, I think it was probably really groundbreaking and first level exposure for a lot of people across the country, right? You know, outside of the pockets of Black folks who were highly educated and so forth. My thing is that where we are today, in light of these pieces of knowledge and historical facts been known even prior to, you know, 1966, my question is, I just wonder why we as a community didn't put an infrastructure in place for this to be disseminated in a much more robust way that would be independent of the normal structure of, you know, public school or schools, things like that, something that we could self-contain and maintain ourselves. Because it looks like, you know, it appears that there's a, you know, a reawakening or a rebirth, if you will. But at the same time, it's a lot of repeat of history. You know, I don't know if we're living in 2022, 2023, or 1964 or 68 these days. So those would be my first initial thoughts.
That's a great point, Lamar. Absolutely. Absolutely. That was something that kind of struck me when I started going through and looking at some of this content, because I'm going through, one of the things that the pandemic allowed me to do was actually spend hours going through some of this content that I'm looking at. And I was shocked at some of the stuff that I was seeing that had never seen the light of day. So I think that it's a good question. Like, why was it not massively distributed? And maybe it could be because of the time it was in. When I looked at some statistics on 1965, and what I seen was about, when you look at the United States as a whole, they said about the average TV consumption in each household was about 23 minutes. So I'm not sure if I think that's probably could contribute to why nobody actually saw it, maybe because of the time it was in, or maybe it kind of got buried after, a few people had seen it, because the way I found it was basically doing some really extensive research and actually having to reformat it and get it to in such a way that I could really understand what I was actually looking at. And then when I actually got it out, I realized, man, that's a young Dr. Clark. I was like, yeah. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what's going on here? And I just watched the whole thing. And then there are some other segments that I'm trying to get together to kind of piece together. And then there's even some silent film that I'm gathering that is kind of amazing too. So I don't know. It's a good question. Now, what do you think, Professor Ra, about that time? Because you were, 11th grader during that time. Is this something that you've seen? I mean, was it on ABC, NBC? Do you remember it being, played a lot, or what do you think?
Well, I'm gonna let others talk. Then I'll sum it up. Let me just say this.
All right.
A lot of the issue of our identity with Euro-American definitions of us came from our parents, who were severely oppressed, and they got it from religious groups, and they got it from just trying to keep the oppression up off of them by going along with whatever the European put out. But the majority of Black people, really wasn't going to college or going to places or traveling to places that lifted. The Garvey movement was back in the 20s and 30s, and then we had the Nation of Islam. So there was information out there, you understand, but it was a situation whereas it was only a small groups of Black people until after the Watts Rebellion, when organizations grew and a thirst for knowledge, and with the development of Black history and modern Black conscious movements, Black liberation movement, dealt with it in the things that people saw, not just the Watts Rebellion, but the abuse of the Pettus Bridge, the treatment of Martin Luther King, and the civil rights movement was a wake-up process. So, they brought out some good things in the video, going back to the continent and raising some of those issues. I don't think they went back far enough, but it was good. And a lot of the people that were speaking in the video grew. Brother Ozzie Davis, he did the eulogy for Malcolm. And he wasn't calling Malcolm a Negro. He called him our Black Prince, our example of Black manhood. And so, but in the video, he said, I'm an American Negro.
Right, so, yeah. That's a little shocking, yeah. I've seen that.
I want to get to a brother, Joe Hembrick, because, he does a lot about the Arab intrusion into Africa and the devastation that the video brought out. But Brother Hembrick been pointing that out throughout his educational career and Brother Hembrick is a longtime educator for Compton Unified School District, Linwood Unified School District, and administrator, and a person that did personal research. He created a mural for Black and Brown Unity it's still up at Centennial High School, and he often lectured to young people about life and about character development and purpose. So, Brother Henry, what was your take on the video, the parts that you saw?
I look like another brother trying to. Was it another brother trying to speak in on the picture on the train?
With the hand up?
No, he's gone now, but he was. But anyway, looking at the video, like you said, I don't think they went back far enough. because there were some other findings that were much older, such as Lucy and Bosie, which were found to be 3.5 million and 1.7 million years old, I believe. And when they talk about the Kushite Empire, there's a lot more history before that that they didn't bring out. Like Basil Davidson, I give him a lot of credit. I have a lot of his books I found at an old bookstore over by El Camino College. And he's one of the Europeans I credit for writing the truth. But when it came to the Arab thing, as I was looking at the video, as you see, they were saying about the Arabs invaded and the brother and the people on the horses was brothers. And right. And what I've been trying to get brothers who are of that faith, belief, persuasion, if you will, that they invaded, you know, Egypt and Africa 1,000 years before the European did and started their own enslavement. And use those offsprings to push it towards the northwest, and it swept across the northwest. And you know they went up into Spain, and that's where you get the Moors and all of that. But this term "Negro," like Dr. Clark says, is definitely demeaning. I believe it comes from the Greek. But Negro, which means dead, you know, like we're dead people, but we're really dead in the head due to what has happened to us over these last 3,000 years or so. Dr. Clark is young in this presentation. Let me say this about in America. And like the brother said, the large gap between the time periods. Well, the Harlem Renaissance during the 20s, I think, was our greatest movement of a group of Black people in America. A lot of people think the 60s, they say the 60s and whatnot. But the 20s, there were a lot of organizations going on, John Henry Clark, when he was a teenager, him and Dr. Ben were members of the Harlem History Club that was run by Arthur Schoenberg. And people involved in that was Willis Blyden, the brother who they called a Black Sick, Socrates, Hubert Harrison. These brothers, they would send emissaries around the world to bring back the truth of what was happening with African people around the world. But after that period of, you know, after the demise of Garvey made him leave the country. What's that word I'm looking for?
Exile.
And then with the increase of the lynchings throughout the whole United States, seemed like, you know, things kind of faded away. And I think that's our problem now, is what I call fear of the sting of the lash, even today. You know, few people of African descent end up with jobs and experience a little prosperity, and things seem to fade as far as, you know, movement and whatnot. But I have this is my position, and this is what I was hoping the film would say when it talked about all the cultural things that we've adopted,
right,
since we've been here, and that we need to discard all of it to get back to where we were. And I know people don't want to embrace that because due to our education and our religious upbringing, you know, we're still on that path. But until you did, like I say, one bad apple spoils the bunch. Well, when you got any of that still in your psyche, in your culture, in your education, in your belief system, religious or what have you, it's still there. and you cannot get back to what the brother was saying. We need to get back to what we were before we were invaded by anyone, where our people could sleep through the night and not have to worry about anybody breaking in on you, stealing anything from you. I remember studying about the, I guess it's called, forget the name of the book. The Pale Fox, where it talks about the Mali Empire and the Dogon people, how they could leave in the marketplace, wouldn't have to put their stuff up overnight, just leave it there, and the next day would be there, and nothing would be stolen. Can you imagine anybody now setting up some Nike shoes or something like that and leave it overnight without it up, and it's gonna be there? No. But it is because we're of this man's cultural thinking process, and it's been absorbed into our psyche. And I like to emphasize the books, and I, Brother Hood, I appreciate your book. I got your book list years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And you got mine. And
yes.
Thank you for taking all of my videos and turning them into DVDs and CDs. I appreciate you for that. But I know
likewise.
Information also.
Most definitely. You know, not to cut you off, Mr. Henry, but you gave me an idea about something. So you said the '20s, right? You said 1920s, right? And so that was kind of like the peak of Black Wall Street during those '20s. And I did some research, and all the black banks, the height of the black banks existed in the '20s. So tell me this: are you saying that as far as the collective, as a people, the term was not Negro; it was colored or black. What would you say we have a collective agreement on what our label was? Because it seems to me, just from watching the video, it seems like, you know, the term Negro is supposed to be people who are upwardly mobile, college educated, and kind of agree on being a good citizen. But what I'm trying to understand is like, at what point, you know, did that classification change? Was that pushed by us, or what was it? Because as I'm looking at it, I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking of the United Negro College Fund, Negro College Fund, and it's still in existence, but they don't use the word Negro on there. And I'm trying to understand, like, as far as, you know, how that played. I mean, so basically I could see, you know, it created a divisiveness with us as far as I'm black, I'm not a Negro. And then if you're not a Negro, well, you can't go to college, or, you know what I'm saying? I'm just trying to like consciously understand that part of the classification that we were kind of fighting against during that time.
Let me say this, Brother Hood. I'm not to when it changed, you know, we would call us Negroes, colored, and all of that, and all these institutions and these so-called historical black colleges and all of that. And what we need to understand about that is those institutions that we speak of and stick our chests out about are still controlled by white folks. They're the ones created. And whenever you're getting your funding from the man, you're going to call yourself what he wants you to call you if you want to keep getting the money. You know, that's why Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark were fired from all of these black colleges, and not just black ones, but European colleges, you know, throughout Europe and America, were fired for teaching the truth. And if you want that money to keep coming in, then you'll go along, you know, with the dance. For example, I talk to a lot of students who go to black colleges, and I ask them questions about certain figures in countries of Africa. And they don't know jack. You know, I said, how in the world can you be at a black college of engineering, and you don't know where Imhotep is and stuff like that? And so, you know, they give you a little taste, and then they still bombard us with the cultural things they want us to continue to partake in, because it's going to continue to hinder our progress between our ears, what we are and what we were and what we need to be. And let me say this, because another point you made about...
I got you, DX. I got you next.
About, Thank you.
about the institutions that you talked about. You know, how come, you know, this stuff wasn't created after this stuff was known? Well, anyway, these professional athletes and attainers and what have you, well, all that they got going on. For example, if you go to a Jewish area, they have what's called a Jewish community center. They got athletic stuff, they got library, they got museum, they got all of this stuff that their kids partake of and have a place to go. I guess the closest thing we had to was the team post. It's probably the closest thing we had to that. But these people have all this money where this stuff can flourish if our kids get it at an early stage, you know, in life, and then can, you know, propel it into where we're trying to go. Because just think of this, if we just think of this, everything that these Europeans have gotten rich off of comes from Africa. Natural resources, rubber, gold, all of even the things that make the atomic bombs, everything comes from there. So why aren't the Africans benefiting from it? You see, and when someone rises up to make us aware of what's going on and what we ought to do, like Idi Amin, a lot of people think he's a cannibal and a madman, but that's something he did. You Europeans, get out of my country. You're not benefit off of our stuff any longer. And the American press painting him as a madman, talking about he crucifying Christians. And that was it for Black America. You know, you do anything against them Christians. Oh, they, and matter of fact, I brought this up at an assembly at Centennial that we were going to do. And the brother that was the director of the thing thought I was a madman for, you know, even mentioned Idi Amin. But we're so programmed and brainwashed, but, it, you know, we're all from the same system. And brother, it took me 6 years as while I was teaching before I woke up myself. So we're all victims. We didn't get there overnight. We're not getting out of it overnight. But there's some things we need to give some serious thought to about us and the cultural things that we do and what's hindering us from getting to where we need to be. And I'm gonna leave this last point. Now, Dr. Clark talked about, you know, how they broke up the, you know, the lots of slaves and sold them off and all that, this and that. And all of us know that some people that just got here on the boat yesterday are passing us up in every aspect of life, so to speak, okay? Why? They held on to their cultural consciousness that they had when they got here that we do not have. And that's why they're sticking together, building together, growing together, and becoming a force to be reckoned with, and we are not. And I'm gonna end my comments right there. And I appreciate you, Brotherhood. I'm so proud of you. My chest is busting out. You know, I'm glad to see what you're doing and keep doing what you're doing, brother. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Brother Hendrick. Brother Demick, you had your hand up for a long time. What's going on?
Yeah. I really want to, I appreciate everybody.
What's your name? What's your name?
Yeah. I'm DX, aka Dr. Vegan. I have a CBD business. I'm also a musician, metaphysics. An advanced metaphysics and mystic. You know what I mean? I practice shamanism and a few other things. And me and Dr. Hood been friends for a very, very, very long time. He like family to me. So, you know, anytime we get together, have our conversations, you know, he invited me in on the format and I really appreciate it. You know, I'm really grateful. We exchanged a lot of information over the years. I have several books of my own that I've been reading for a very long time. And, you know, just adding on to the cipher here, I think what the video really is expressing, you know what I'm saying, from my opinion, especially during that time, is giving us our people a outlet aside from what was being taught at that time. You know, that everybody's just push monkeys and you know, Africa didn't have nothing. And so the in-depth research of our history, you know what I mean, of where we actually come from and what we're doing now, and even the terms like African-American or Negro, some of these terms, you know, this is my personal opinion, like we have three basic types of people that we may consider human. Some of the other ones we can get into, that's another level. But you have your Negroid, you got your Caucasoid, and you got your Mongoloid. You know, so the identity of us as a people as a whole, no matter where you're from, and even in terms of like us here in this country being, you know, I'm not a descendant from a slave. My granddaddy wasn't a slave. His granddaddy wasn't a slave. I'm from Oklahoma. I'm a descendant of Black Wall Street. You know what I'm saying? So my grandfather, when he tells the story, he didn't pick no cotton. It was a choice. You know, his granddaddy had land. You know, during the 1800s, when they did the census after the Emancipation Proclamation, they made a lot of the natives, whether you was Choctaw, you might have been Pawnee, Cherokee, or Seminole, Blackfoot. If you had kinky hair, they made you, in the census, classify yourself as a Negro. That created what they call the $5 Indian. So a lot of the natives here, like a lot of the what I'm going to call indigenous melanated people, began to identify themselves as Negro, even though they might have been Apache, they might have been Seminole or, you know, Creek or some other native already indigenous that had been here before the Christopher Columbuses came, you know, before there was America Disputes, which is where we get America. So even calling ourselves African American, Africa, the word Africa comes from another explorer, you know, from France or something. And then you got American put on top of that, which is like America Disputes or is a Moroccan guy. It's a name of people and not necessarily a culture or a race in that sense. So it's like we keep identifying ourselves with a slave sort of mentality as belonging to a man or belonging to some ideology of our culture that is already being put in place to say what that means. You know, then you have the Asiatic Black man who are called the Nagas. The Nagas, I'm sure, is where they get the niggas from. You know, it's the same people. But maybe they couldn't pronounce the word right, and they come up with niggas, you know, and we identify ourselves as such, you know what I'm saying? But if you look at the history of the Asiatic Black man who was before the pyramids, before Egypt, and you go back to Asia, you'll find the Nagas. Then you have like the Niger River. You have different terms that already identify a certain level of what the people are, and the people being identified by a certain culture. So because they can't identify us because we in Africa, because we in South America, because we're in North America, we're all over the planet. What's the identity of those people right there that are melanated with this kinky hair? How do we identify these people on a global scale so we can say who they are or identify ourselves, you know what I mean, and get in the form of identity? And I think that's what the film itself was trying to do and the producers was trying to do. Why wasn't it heard? Because Hollywood, of course, is being run by people who don't have our best interests at heart. We've seen that over the years. You know, even with our music, none of these people who are in charge of programming us, because all this is a program, it's a TV program, it's a music program, a school program. These are programs being run on us. So it, like the doctor just said a while ago, Brother Armin, it's going to take more than just an overnight situation because we have to reprogram the program. It's like we're the Morpheuses now. We have to give them the red pill to get them out of the matrix to let them see what the reality is. And we're the ones, the thinkers that's coming up with that reality to say, hey, look, you're not a Negro. And if you want to classify your Negro, be a Naga. If you want to classify ourselves as melanated indigenous people, we identify ourselves with the Mohawk. You know, we identify ourselves with our family's bloodline when we can go back and say, hey, my grandmother was an Apache because we live here. We was born here. From a metaphysical perspective, we wasn't born in like Africa, and identifying with Africa is cool. You know what I'm saying? It's like our cousins. But they identify with us the same way with our culture. From what we built here in America, we built one of the best, even now, one of the best civilizations on the planet still. We got our hot running water. We got grocery stores. We got cell phones. We got everything that the world can offer. We have at our grasp. Just being here and being at the lowest class in this society, we still have access to the greatest things that exist in the world. And it's on our backs that we built. So the civilizations in Egypt, yeah, somebody built those. In my opinion, like those people do what we all do. We migrate. We spread out. The cousins move across the street. Then the auntie moves around the corner. Then somebody else moves all the way to New York. And that's what we have. You know what I'm saying? We all over the planet. We can't just identify ourselves with Africa. We can't just identify ourselves with America. We have to identify ourselves from a global perspective in order to get the true respect. And lastly, I'm going to end on this. I think the mentality and what it does to us to identify ourselves greater than what they have given us. Like now we walk around, we profess ourselves as gods. You know what I'm saying? As the deities that create, the deities that manifest, that actualize what we want in life. You know what I mean? That's a higher level of saying we not, y'all not even equal to us anymore. We don't want to be equal to you. Like Malcolm X, we don't want to sit at your counter. We got our own counters we can go sit at. But when we gave up our counters and we gave up our identity, so to speak, to try to be equal to someone or some culture that was not even equal to us from the beginning, that was the downfall. Now we're stepping, I feel like we're stepping back into our true identity and recognizing ourselves as gods. You know what I'm saying? We put on a certain skin when we come on this planet. You know, when you decide you want to be on Earth and you manifest on this Earth as a supreme being, whether you're a melanated man or a melanated woman, to go through the suffrage and still maintain and be at the top of the food chain with nothing and still have value. You know, that's the most powerful thing anybody can ask for. All we got to do is say, hey, we don't agree with that anymore. We don't agree. When we stop agreeing and we can agree with each other and stop agreeing with them, I think that's going to be our rise. That means they have to move aside because we don't agree anymore. That's all I'm going to say right now.
Well, thanks a lot, brother. And thanks a lot for your commentary. And you made some very major points, and we'll discuss them in a minute. But it's Marbury Wright. That Maltree Wright?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. What's that? How you pronounce your first name?
Monty Wright.
Monty Wright. You have any comments?
Yeah, you know, it was good to see, you know, it's good to see, you know, people getting this conversation, you know, started about, you know, who we are, where we are, and, you know, and I guess, you know, recognizing, you know, where we're not, you know what I mean? You know, as far as the documentary, you know, I mean, you know, to me, sometimes it's kind of sad that, you know, stuff from back then, you know what I'm saying, still relate to, I don't know, man, what has been, what's that? How long was that? Like 60, 70 years ago?
Yeah, 57.
Right. So, you know, we still got a lot of work to do, you know what I mean? As far as, you know, getting this content out and getting it in the right ears and just, I guess, you know, developing a whole generation around this kind of talk and this kind of movement, because it's obvious, you know, it's been, you know, two or three generations lost because, you know, I'm in my late 40s and, you know, when none of this stuff on my mind, so I really got in my 30s, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, that's after, you know what I'm saying? That's like my man said, that's after you already been programmed. So you got to reprogram yourself, you know what I'm saying? That takes a long time. And so like my other man was saying about how the Jewish got their stuff set up to where, you know what I'm saying, they children can go and have access to different things that revolves around their culture. We need that same thing because, you know, to be learning this information so late, you know what I'm saying? Believe me, I'm gonna be pushing it off to young ones I know and my little one. But we, like I said, we got to be developing a whole generation from the beginning on this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Because that's where we lose them, because they getting us with their stuff from the very beginning. You know what I mean? And so we losing too much time. That's where I'm at with it.
Okay. Rasha,
but yeah, man, it's good that it seemed like everybody, you know, on the feed is in the same space, and it's really gonna be up to brothers like us, because, you know,
appreciate it.
It's not enough of us.
Okay. Appreciate it.
I think
Lamar
has
it.
Brother Rasha, are you there?
Yes. Go ahead and let Brother Lamar Hillary. You have his hand up.
Lamar.
Okay. Appreciate that. I just have a couple points. Number one, I understand, you know, how we can tend to romanticize. I mean, there's based on facts and true history, but I don't want us to go down the slippery slope of like all Black people lived in peace and harmony on the continent, because empires exist because they resisted other groups of people, other tribes or whatever, from encroaching upon their territory or their space or whatever that may be, economically, socially, politically, whatever. But also I would suggest that you all check out the book called Black Protest. It's a history. It's an analysis of documents and history from 1619 to the present. And the reason why I think that one is very appropriate is because it gives history and examples of how we survive and thrive, even inside of slavery, and then post the Civil War and emancipation and things of that nature, and then the dynamics that led to two eras like the 1920s and prior to. And I will say this, as it relates to the Harlem Renaissance and Black Wall Street, this wasn't the only factor, but you can't divorce this factor from all that was accomplished and what you read about. And that is a segregated Jim Crow society that forced us to rely on each other. Right. And that was a social construct that now isn't as present, that forces us. So we have to look at things from learning from history and say, how do we, like the other groups that continue to be insular economically and so forth, how do we get to that point so that we have an engine and a platform upon which to stand? On all fronts, economically, politically, and so forth. So those are just my few comments there.
All right. Thanks, Lamar.
Yeah. Brother Rasha King?
Yeah, a lot of what everybody's saying is kind of similar. And I think Brother Hembrick, you know, I could kind of mirror what he's saying. We definitely have to, I say we have to delete everything we learned from this system and upload anew. And if it's information that's ancient and that's constructive, you know, I'm an avid listener of Brother Neely Fuller. And I know we got some Oklahoma people on here. He's from Muskogee, Oklahoma. And this brother has his counter-racist code is, you could take the counter-racism out, and it's based off of being constructive. And if we can get that type of mentality, we're doing things that make sense, I think we'll be on our way. And I think we are doing it.
What's his brother's name? What's his brother's name in Muskogee?
Neely Fuller Jr. He's in D.C. now, but that's where he's from.
Neely
Fuller Jr.
Neely Fuller Jr.
Yeah, he has a producejustice.com. He has a counter-racist code book out. And the brother is 93, 94 years old and has a weekly show.
Wow.
On producejustice.com. And, I mean, the information is excellent. And, you know, it's brothers like Professor Amin-Ra that came before me and brought me into some consciousness. We're actually doing it, and we just gonna have to keep doing it. So I mirror a lot of things that everyone spoke of, and we just got to keep doing what we're doing, and we got to put what we're doing into our daily practice. You know, we can't be self-contradictory, and I find myself sometimes being that way, working on it. So I appreciate all you brothers here, and we on every week, twice a week. So we're here. If you're interested, you know, get in contact with us. Brother Hood is one of our people, so, and he's y'all people, so we need to build.
Yeah, definitely. Brother Roski, DX definitely was somebody I mentioned in a while back about a potential guest. So we'll wrap back around, maybe get him on a future episode. But I definitely appreciate all you brothers showing up and just chiming in. Brother, go ahead.
Let me say this. You know, our struggle is a diverse struggle for different goals and different objectives. But the root of the struggle was liberation, freedom. Freedom to be ourselves. And in order to be yourself, you have to free yourself. And you can't be yourself unless you free yourself. The most important thing is not the names or the trying to come up with a universal identity that you can get a large percentage of African people or people from the continent of Africa that's named Akivalon, Olympia, you know, Ethiopia. They had all kinds of names for the continents, 12 million square miles. But the point is, it's the land of where Black people come from. You understand, the continent. White folks come from the Caucasoid Mountains. Chinese come from China. Mexicans come from Mexico. El Salvadorans come from land that they acculturated and developed as an ethnic group. And so, you know, they built their customs, their culture, and their lives there. But from the standpoint of the Negro, we're not worried. Because some Black people or some people of African descent are of dark pigmentation and things, they still call themselves Negroes today. You know, I mean, you can't get mad at people. You have to go where the people are and then bring them to where your consciousness is. The oppressor can't be our teacher. You can't. You know, white folks ain't gonna, I mean, that's been the problem. They've been our teachers and they've taught many of the Black people that are our teachers. And so therefore, you know, it creates a very challenging point. Most Black churches, mosques, synagogues, temples are mirrors of European ideologies and philosophies. The reason you have Black churches because they came up under white churches. You have Black fraternities because they came up under white. The whites wouldn't let them in, so they started their own. But the point is that we're talking about mentalities, not just a name of an identity. And Malcolm made it clear when he said there's a difference between the field Negro and the house Negro. And he made a distinction. And then as he evolved into the Nation of Islam, there are three major mentalities to a certain perspective that I used to try to get students to see and categorize Black people in. The Negro mentality is came from Spanish. The word, if you look up the word Black in Spanish, it means Negro. And Spain was the biggest, one of the biggest contributors to the Holocaust of enslavement of African people. And so some of the first colonies, Spain was involved there. When they fought with Hannibal and Rome and all of that, you know, Spain is in Europe. Spaniards are white. They're not Mexicans, they're white. Mexicans speak Spanish the same reason we speak English. They were conquered by white Spaniards, you know. And the point is that it's a mentality. And when most people who say I'm a Negro, they are absorbed, totally absorbed into Euro-American culture. Many of them are middle class, and many of them own property, and many of them are deeply Christian religious, and many of them are believe that the white man ice is colder and the sugar is sweeter, and many of them marry white people, and many of them in love with white people, and they go to white programs and sit up there and be like a flea in milk, sitting up in there, and they move in white neighborhoods if they could get in there, and just say, I'm the only Negro here, and they brag about it. And that's absorption. Not only absorption from the standpoint of trying to be white, but actually perpetuating Eurocentric culture on their kids and wherever they work and wherever they teach. I mean, they are agency. They have an agency with white folks' domination. And they don't see white people as an enemy. They see them as an ally and an example and a goal that they want to achieve. They want to, some of them even say they wish they were white. Some of them bleach themselves. Some of them wear yellow wigs. Some of them are just completely into the European culture. You know, they're out there at the damn Rose Parade, sitting up there looking at, talking about the flowers are beautiful. You know, I mean, these are Negroes out there, you know? I mean, a conscious person ain't going to go out there who understand that, you know, that's the European thing, the Rose Parade. But then there's the Afro-American. That's assimilation. As one brother pointed out, you know, you said, well, I'm American based upon my location. But I'm African based upon my heritage. I don't know what African community I'm from, what ethnic group I'm from, so I claim the whole thing. That's why I say I'm African-American. But you're talking about assimilation. They have what they call a compound identity. They identify with America socially, culturally, and essentially as a part of relying on them for education, for employment, and even business opportunities and entrepreneurship. But at the same time, sometimes they may name their kids an African name, and sometimes they may not. But most of them are just into assimilation. And as one brother pointed out, the Black movement, which was always here, but it really took off in the 60s after the Watts Rebellion, there was a movement. There was two movements during the 60s, civil rights, an integrationist movement, and a Black power, Black liberation movement. And, you know, when Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, and Willie Ricks, during the March Against Fear, when they shot the brother who was trying to integrate Alabama, and shot him, they went and redid the march. They were marching, and that's when they popularized the term Black power. Mm-hmm. And out of that, the Watts Rebellion popped up a lot of organizations that say we're not no longer Negro. We are African, we are Black. And they started what they call the Black Arts Movement, the Black Conscious Movement, the Black History Movement, and the Black Cultural Movement, and the Black Resistance Movement. And that lasted all the way up until the 80s to a certain degree. But at the same time, the system spent so much money to counterintelligence programs, and they paid big money to get spies and infiltrate and created conflict among Black organizations. And but there's some institutions that are still here that rose out of the Black movement. Many, even the Negro colleges, 100 Negro colleges changed their name to the HBCU, Historical Black College, even though some of them are still safe. But some of them do good things. They did produce some conscious people. Martin Luther King went there, and other Black movement people went there. And so that's a beautiful thing. But Blackness is isolation. So you have the mentality of the absorption by the Negro, the compound identity by the African-American, and then you have the Black identity, Black Panthers, Black Muslims, Black Liberation Army, Black the US organization. Everything was Black. And it was beautiful. People start wearing naturals, wearing African garments, changing their names, doing, you know, that's the mark of a liberated people. And they call that the liberation mentality, or the resistance and liberation movement. And so those mentalities are still in existence today. And many of them are working hard. Now, but what happens is, sometimes people who are not into the movement and don't study the movement, you know, you got a reparations movement, you got so many movements today, and the media don't cover them. I mean, what they did with George Floyd, what they did with Michael Brown, what they did with Breonna Taylor, what they did with Trayvon Martin, these are Black people that got out in the street and they said Black Lives Matter. They didn't say Negro Lives Matter. They said Black Lives Matter. Because regardless of how you see yourself, the system see you as Black. As they said, if you had an inkling of blood in you that was Negroic at that time, they considered you a Negro or Black. And you can go around here and say, I ain't, I'm this and I'm that. That's what you say. But the system says something else. Now, in our birth certificates was the word Negro for years. In our baptism certificates, the word Negro was there. Our parents taught us that we were Negro. That was there. And until you get a liberated mentality, you know, your parents name you Robert, name you Paul, name you your daughters, Shabana, Antoinette, and all that. You know, they don't go by their historical identity or culture. And demonstrate liberation. Free people rename themselves and name themselves once they get liberated. But when you still don't, and I'm not criticizing anybody that love their name and name that to their daddy, their mama, then keep it. That's beautiful. But are you in the struggle? Are you conscious? You know, you got Black people that were real conscious Black people. They married white women. You know, Imamu Baraka. You know, married a white woman. Frederick Douglass married a white woman. Dick Gregory, he didn't marry him, but he messed around with him, as well as Jesse Jackson and all of them. You know, it's a rare Negro that make middle class money that don't have a white mistress some damn where. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, you got ball players marrying them. The women, man, white men, you see it all over. You know, I think married people who come from a heritage of enslaving and putting genocide on you. But, you know, that's you. I ain't gonna hold it against you. You understand? Because we got bigger fish to fry. And that is to get these chains off our neck. But some people are hugging James, and they're comfortable in their oppression. And they talk a lot of talk, but what organization are you in? What struggle was you in? 1965, I was throwing so many rocks. I went to jail for 45 days during the Watts Rebellion as a juvenile. They wouldn't let the juveniles out. Adults could bail out, but juveniles, you was retained for 45 days. And I put on a year probation, and you understand, because people came up there as a basketball player, so they helped get me out. But the point is, man, the struggle continues, and we're still struggling. We just had a seven-day celebration of family, culture, and community called Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa came out of the Black movement. It didn't come out of nobody going up there asking white folks to recognize Juneteenth or recognize his role in liberating us and all of that. This was a Black thing, and the revolution's going to come from a Black thing. So my point to you, Brotherhood, this is a good video for commentary. We want to thank everybody that spoke. And next week, I think you're going to show part two. Is that right?
Yeah. What I'm doing is I'm going through and seeing what I can, you know, get together and try to get the second version. It could be the part two of this video or some other content during that same period, and try to share it.
But as Joe's brother Hembrick, it's not Hembrick saying, the continent of Africa is one of the richest mineral of areas on the planet. And why is it in such a disarray? You can go and you can trace the role of Europeans who right now they're fighting wars in Africa between other groups. They corrupt the leaders. They do all kinds of stuff to make sure that Africa never tries to make Africa not get its liberation. That's what assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, the assassination of many Black leaders, Idi Amin, that's why Africa is in the shape it's in. So those are the things that we can. So Rasha Key, you want to tell them about next week? And are you in good?
Is Rasha Key there? Well, what I'll do is, oh, he's there. There you go.
Yeah. On Wednesday, we got Brother Thomas. He's going to interview his father. And then if you check out the website soon, we have the flyers from Brother Hood coming on the 25th. Then on the 29th, we have Priestess Victoria's coming on from Ghana. So we always have some good content coming on. So yeah, that's what we got going. All right, Brother Hood, you wanted to say something?
No, that's about it for me. I just want to appreciate the invite and getting an opportunity to finally present something. And I'm looking forward to sharing more video content as I pour over some of this stuff. Some of it is classic stuff. Some of it is stuff nobody's ever heard of or ever seen. So I'm looking forward to just continue sharing everything that I can. So that's it for me. Appreciate everybody showing up. That's about it for me.
Rashki. Let me mention this. Is this documentary that's done by Bill Cosby? It's called Black History: Lost, Stolen, or Strayed. You might want to look that up to help.
I got that one. That one's on the list. Got that one right now. Yeah, I got that one ready to go.
I just want to pass something on. And let me mention this.
Yeah, definitely. I got that one ready to go.
The brother that spoke right after me. There's a book called America BC. By Barry Fell, which talks about a lot of the stuff that he's talking about. And it was only five of them in the state, and I stole one from the library about 30 years ago until I finally found my own copy. It was called America BC by Barry Fell. All right. I'm out.
Okay. So you know what? Just since Hendrick mentioned it, I think I may do that. That may be the next video. We'll just do the lost history, and then we'll just go ahead and put that on there. But it's a really good documentary as well. It was done by Bill Cosby and blew me away because I'd never seen Bill Cosby in that light. I mean, me growing up, I looked at Bill Cosby as kind of like a self-hating brother. So when I seen the video, it just kind of shocked me that nobody knew it existed. So
I used to show it to my classes back when it first came out.
Okay.
And, you know, it's very long. And, you know, he starts off strong and he narrates it all the way up to where they start going to independent school and talk about the class changes and things of that nature. It's a good video. Lost, Stolen, and Astray, narrated by Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have to do that in almost three parts.
Okay. Okay. I got it. I definitely found that one. That was another one. But other than that, I just, you know, peace and blessings to everybody. And, you know, thanks for having me again and brothers for showing up. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right. Brother Hood, stay on for a minute, man.
All right.
For sure. All right, Pastor T. You know what I got to do in the morning.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Conscious Corner. Each one, teach one.